it's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate, and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
Ryan Fatica, I'm a reporter and editor with Perilous Chronicle, and I've covered Lauren's case in collaboration with Forgive Everyone.
Yate, she kli dasha jina, tori chi ni shabashti na kudina dashanella shuma e beitha chi auto beitha chi dasha che. My name is Kli Benali. I'm originally from Black Mesa on the Diné or Navajo Nation. Currently, I reside in Flagstaff, and I organize with a range of groups, Kinfuna Mutual Aid, Indigenous Action, as well as a newly formed anti-state repression crew outside of Kinfuna or Flagstaff. We've been doing some support for Lauren Reed as well.
Awesome. That's who we're going to be talking about today. And also, you're a part of a new podcast that's on the Channel Zero Network. We want to shout that out and encourage people to listen to that as well.
Oh, yeah. With Indigenous Action, we just finally succumbed to all the pressure, the peer pressure. You know, everybody else is doing it, so we might as well. And yeah, it's a great format. It's been really wild and fun, and we just want to put it up. So yeah, check it out, Indigenous Action Podcast.
So just to get us started, let's talk about who Lauren Reed is and why they were charged with one count of what the state is calling threats to damage and destroy a building by means of fire, which carries a maximum sentence of 10 years in prison and a fine of up to $250,000. Just walk us through this case and tell us who Lauren is.
Lauren Reed is a 26-year-old Indigenous Diné man, and he grew up in Page, Arizona, a small town, northern Arizona. And this summer, he was observing the protests going on across the country, inspired by them. And you know, he kind of saw this as his moment to speak to people about an issue that was already on his mind: police brutality, police murder of everyone but Black and Brown people, Indigenous people across the country. And in response, he tried to organize a protest in his small town. Page, Arizona is a town of 7,000 people and a lot of right-wing presence, conservative presence, but he wanted to organize a protest to speak out in this moment. And so he organized a private Facebook chat called Fuck 12 to organize this protest. And so he's in this private Facebook group, and in the discovery that comes out in his indictment, the FBI alleges that in this chat, he types into the chat, "I want to burn down the courthouse." And so the FBI responds to this as a threat to burn down a building and by use of interstate commerce, which they can do by with anything that happens over the internet. And so they throw this case on him with a maximum sentence of 10 years, and they collaborated with the Page PD to do an investigation. They put an undercover Facebook alias, were able to gain access with their undercover alias into the private Facebook chat and took screenshots of these chats. And as a result, Lauren was arrested on June 2nd of this year and placed immediately in the Coconino County Jail and spent 30 days there. During his time there, he got COVID because the jail was unwilling to take proper precautions, get him the cleaning supplies that he and his fellow incarcerated people were asking for. And after that, he was transferred to Florence, Arizona, to the Central Arizona Florence Correctional Facility run by CoreCivic, which houses the majority of the federal marshals, prisoners in the state of Arizona. And he's been incarcerated for 6 months, pre-trial. Because of COVID, their grand juries weren't functioning in Arizona, and so his right to a speedy trial was waived. He sat in pretrial detention for 4.5 months or so without an indictment. And finally, a federal grand jury indicted him in September. And now he's sitting still, waiting for trial.
Well, I think it's important to recognize that, like, Page in Northern Arizona is really a sort of, like, tourist trap, but also, like, the economy is established by, like, extractive industries. It's really in an area that borders the Diné or Navajo Reservation. And so, like, recently, one of the big sort of industries there, the Navajo Generating Station, which burns coal from Black Mesa, where I come from, and provides energy for the Salt River Project, which basically is just a big, you know, coal burning, steam electric powering project to source water to Phoenix and Tucson. You know, in this community, as Ryan mentioned, it's really small, but there's like, if you drive through Page, there's like churches on every corner. You know, it's like really driven by the exploitation of indigenous communities and the ongoing sort of like colonial recreationism that we see with this lake there. That's an artificial lake that was created by the dam, another, you know, resource extractive industry that flooded out the canyon, drowned indigenous folks, like, and desecrated our sacred homelands. And so this is part of the context and the backdrop in the area that this case is going on. And I think as we discuss this through the rest of the podcast, it's important to understand in relation to the context. And what we're facing today is this sort of new political environment with extreme state surveillance and repression.
Well, on that note, let me ask you, based on what Ryan was saying. So this is a town of like 7,000 people. Was the FBI already in this private chat, or somehow they got in and then saw his comments later?
From what I understand from the complaint, that the Page PD were the ones who infiltrated this private chat and then notified the FBI.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
They got an, just to add to that, they got an anonymous, or they got a tip from someone who Lauren went to high school with, who saw his chat, saw his comments on the internet, the ones that were public, and called the Page Police Department and filed and made a complaint that someone was quote unquote trying to start a riot in Page. And from there, they began their investigations.
The local right-wing press, from our understanding, this is based on the article that's on Perilous Chronicle, labeled Lauren, quote, the Arizona emo anarchist. And I'm just curious, what role did the media play in this case?
Yeah, so immediately upon his arrest, the local media just swarmed his Facebook page. And Lauren's got an intentionally provocative Facebook presence. He's, you know, has pointed out that his whole Facebook presence is sort of ironic and intended to just sort of be provocative. But he's got pictures on his header of his Facebook that contains a circle A. And so as a result of that, the local media dubbed him an anarchist. And then he hasn't ever told me that he's an anarchist, but he has certainly told me many times that he's emo. And so there's a picture of him on his Facebook page with wearing a red hat that says Make America Emo Again. And so the media jumped on that and just sort of reposted totally uncritically the complaint, quoting it verbatim with all the most provocative aspects of his Facebook page, in a fairly typical collaboration between the police and hack media to sort of try him and railroad him publicly.
Yeah, and this is a typical strategy that we see with a range of cases. You know, it's interesting, especially when, like, you know, right-wing media or just mainstream media will, like, consider anarchists or other folks as, like, so-called or, you know, self-styled. In this case, they just sort of jump to that conclusion, but solely for the purpose of vilifying him. And that's part of, like, the issues, like, addressing these cases in the court of public opinion. But, you know, I mean, who isn't an anarchist, who isn't emo? I mean, I think, like, this overall framing and the messaging is something that actually, I think Ryan and Tark, the Tucson Anti-Repression Committee, has really helped to bring to light and address this case and reframe it on our terms, which I think is really critical in addressing a lot of these situations where the state is attacking dissent, hyper-criminalizing it, but also, you know, the media is helping to facilitate that, at least right-wing and mainstream corporate media, helping to facilitate that by, you know, sort of creating these characterizations to be able to assassinate folks on this level.
I wanted to go back to the initial charge, the threats to damage and destroy a building by means of fire. I'm just curious. So, I mean, he's literally being charged with just making a threat?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, the FBI, upon his arrest, searched his car and searched the house that he'd been staying in, obviously in an attempt or hope of finding evidence, physical evidence of a plan, and found none. They, you know, the biggest thing they could say in terms of a tangible attempt to carry out this plan is that they found a half a bottle of rubbing alcohol in his possession, which is sort of a ridiculous thing that came up at his detention hearing. They felt it reasonable to mention that he had a standard, you know, half bottle of rubbing alcohol in his presence that could be, I guess, potentially used as to create fire. But no, they're not even making an attempt to demonstrate that they think he had had been doing anything physically to prepare to carry out such a threat. The Facebook chat did contain other statements. He and his friends are kind of going back and forth. The chat is, it's ridiculous. It's a Facebook chat among, you know, young people. It's got memes. It's, you know, they're saying ludicrous things. And so the FBI is taking those things out of context and attempting to say that these were constitute true threats. But yeah, they weren't spoken. No one said them to, for example, an employee of the courthouse. They weren't directed at anyone in particular. It's a private Facebook chat. People are saying these things about, like, what if we did this? What if we did that to each other? Apparently that constitutes, according to the FBI and the prosecution, constitutes threats that can be punished with 10 years in prison. The trouble is with federal charges, the rates of plea bargains, the rates of guilty verdicts are so high, that people facing federal charges, the likelihood that they will actually beat those charges is so low that it ends up creating a situation where the prosecution and the FBI can essentially try someone, just by charging them, because the likelihood that that charge will stick is, you know, well over 90%. And so that's the situation that Lauren finds himself in.
How does this fit into the larger targeting and crackdown of anarchists and anti-fascists and other autonomous social movements? I mean, especially in Arizona, we know that there's been numerous like memos and stuff that have come to light that have shown the state surveilling anarchists and radical anti-colonial groups. We've talked about this on It's Going Down before. You know, they've also kind of under the guise of surveilling anti-borders and anti-ICE activity have really focused on anarchists. Sometimes, I mean, going to the extent of like promoting kind of wild conspiracy theories about like Mexican drug cartels working with anti-border activists and things like this. So I'm just curious, you know, how does this fit into this larger kind of trend?
I guess I can respond. I mean, I think we've seen systematic attacks that have escalated post-Occupy. And so, you know, as far as like the FBI fusion centers and the anti-terrorism task force that were developed out of Homeland Security post 9/11, you know, that has sort of like escalated and grown and taken an inward look. You know, we saw that with FBI Operation Backfire, which heavily impacted folks in Arizona. So, you know, Bill Rogers, who was coordinating out of the info shop down in Prescott, and the Catalyst Info Shop, and, you know, a range of other folks throughout our community in this region. You know, there's a long history of FBI going after environmental movements and so forth. And so more recently, though, what we sort of consider is this new political environment, specifically using social media as a mechanism to surveil and use, you know, the guest lists off of Facebook events, use people who have tagged themselves in photos or tagged other people, looked at timestamps, looked at, you know, identification. And I've been actually charged now multiple times, faced different charges from different cases, specifically because the not federally, but the state forces used social media to surveil. And there was one case after a Indigenous Peoples Day march, we just took the streets. We faced a month-long investigation that used a whole range of resources, including partnership with the FBI down in Phoenix to identify another organizer that was allegedly part of this demonstration. And then they came at us with charges. I actually also faced federal charges some years ago, I think back in 2011, for my role in some actions addressing the threat of desecration by Arizona Snowball, which is a ski resort here, threatening to desecrate the San Francisco Peaks, which is a mountain holy to 13 indigenous nations. And we've waged decades-long resistance that has escalated. And with this escalation, we faced a three-month-long investigation and then ultimately faced federal charges with terrorism enhancement that was targeting one person. And that was like a mix of like traditional forms of surveillance with like following people, documenting folks at demonstrations. But they also used, they heavily relied on social media posts that people had made and tried to link folks up, for these charges specifically. But, this dynamic isn't, you know, distinct. Obviously we're seeing this throughout, the so-called U.S. And I think we saw, it really, be applied in, a very focused way at Standing Rock. And then post Standing Rock, especially like with the private contractors, the forces that were used by the Dakota Access Pipeline, and then how the state also infiltrated and used social media specifically to go after folks as well. And so those, you know, we're seeing more and more of these cases, especially in the midst of the George Floyd uprisings. And I think especially regarding the border issues, you all could probably talk more about that, Ryan, regarding TARC's work. And then one more thing is like, we also were made aware, because I organized with Tullahoan Info Shop, and we hosted quite a few years ago, we hosted an anti-fascist, anti-colonial gathering, and we found out that the FBI had done a report that was looking at anarchist threats around border regions, and they specifically had an informant identified. They didn't identify their name, but they identified that there was an informant in attendance at our gathering, and they had seen that there were firearms in display because one of the workshops was self-defense and use of arms in anti-fascist, anti-colonial organizing and so forth. And they flagged us for that in this report. So, you know, this is something that we've been addressing, finding different creative ways to, of course, improve security culture and build out more infrastructure for support to ensure that those who get targeted by the state aren't standing alone.
As Clea mentioned, I've been collaborating with a group called the Tucson Anti-Repression Crew or Committee that was formed, like a lot of anti-repression committees were formed in the wake of the summer's uprisings, because the wave of repression has been very powerful, as you know, we should expect, following a very powerful wave of protest. Many people across the country are facing charges, federal charges, also state and local charges. And so people here in Tucson formed an anti-repression committee and are following local cases. And it's important, I think, right now that people take note of the fact that when there's a powerful movement there was in the summer that shifts things and threatens to change the world, how it's organized, inevitably there will be a wave of protest or a wave of repression, a little backlash. And that's what we're seeing, both with Lauren's case and with cases across the country.
No justice, just us. No justice, just us. No justice, just us. Nothing left but us. Anti-racist, these black faces, we are screaming. FTP, all power to the people. Take a knee while chanting, I can't breathe. You wanted to fight, well, you got one. 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 Well, you got one. Well, you got one. You wanted to fight. Well, you got one. You wanted to fight. Well, you got it. 'Cause you really, really thought that we'd go quietly, that we would die. Yeah. 12th the biggest gang in the world. 12th the biggest gang in the world. 12th the biggest gang in the world. 12th the biggest. You know, fuck that. We the biggest gang in the world. We the biggest.
One thing to point out, I mean, I just pulled up one article that came to mind while we were talking about this, but in the late summer of this year, there was a bunch of leaked messages that came out of Facebook that were similarly from, like, private Facebook chats that were from, like, far-right MAGA patriot groups, and this is up in the Portland area, and they were discussing literally, like, plans for, like, targeting local politicians, but mostly, like, Black Lives Matter and anti-racist and anti-fascist activists at different events. And, you know, a lot of these people would go on to later engage in different violent actions at different demonstrations. In fact, I think some of the people mentioned in this may have even faced charges later for engaging in violence at different far-right demonstrations. And I think that it's probably safe to say that these groups have infiltrators or people that are reporting to federal law enforcement. But it's important to point out that there seems to be this very clear double standard, and that while the FBI and other agencies may be monitoring the far right, in this instance, they're like, you know, obviously going out of their way to target this individual for just kind of saying some like silly stuff in a private chat. But yet here are these groups that are heavily organized, connected to the local Republican Party, have a history of engaging in violence, are connected to outright white nationalists and neo-Nazis. And they're literally saying like, here's our plan to like go out and hurt people, like physical human beings. And yet there's, I mean, they don't receive the same repression. I'm just curious if y'all want to comment on that, that double standard.
It definitely exists. I mean, it's unbelievable the charges that Lauren's facing, and that he could very realistically, you know, and the FBI is hoping that he does, the prosecution is hoping that he does spend the next 10 years of his life in prison, or, you know, he's got 6 months time served, so 9.5. I mean, the damage, economic damage, emotional damage that's already been done to him and his family and his community, the way that a person's life is just overturned by this period of incarceration, being taken away from everything. To compare the things that he said to the things that are said frequently, even by the president of the United States, you know, I mean, these things that he's accused of saying are extremely moderate compared to other things that we know of is happening in private Facebook chats all the time. I don't know if, you know, I'm not going to speculate as to what led them to bring these charges when they did, but, a double standard definitely exists, and it does fit into a legacy of repression against social movements, particularly indigenous-led social movements, protest movements.
Yeah, I would just add that a double standard implies that there's a standard we sort of agree on and support, where the reality of the legacy of brutality and attacks that have been systematic from well before COINTELPRO have been one that has always preferenced white supremacists, colonizers, and the sort of cis-heteropatriarchal social order. And so we shouldn't be surprised. I think we should be prepared. We can look at the trajectory of escalation of the criminalization of dissent and understand it in terms that I think we should reassert, and that way we can be more prepared. If we're looking at, you know, folks are engaging in like insurrectionary revolutionary actions, you know, we can't fuck around with what we're posting online. And I think that there's been a very powerful wave of security culture that has complemented the uprisings that were triggered after the execution, the police execution of George Floyd. And that has been that folks, you know, you're going to demonstrations now and you're seeing people who are not, you know, they're purposefully not bringing their cell phones. You know, they're not filming everything like voyeurs, you know, for this like sort of social media participatory badges or whatnot, but recognizing the ways that the state has weaponized those and can access through these social media corporations at any given moment, those private communications, or those communications you think may be private to begin with. And we're also seeing that in relation to the suppression of social media pages and sites, just like it's going down, right? A range of other radical projects. So I don't think we should be surprised. And yes, we can identify that it is a hypocrisy or double standard, but we look at the violence of the right and it's not an exception. That's how white supremacy, that's how colonialism has operated since its inception, since its imposition on these lands. So that it continues to attack, criminalize, and lock up our brothers and sisters, our relatives, into its clutches and its systems behind bars. You know, if we're surprised about that, we're missing the context of this ongoing legacy of attacks against our communities the challenge for us is to be prepared to make sure we have the infrastructure to support folks so they do not stand alone, make sure that we have the resources to be able to support folks and be smart, you know, be aware of security culture, build that critical consciousness around these actions and be intentional, be smart or strategic, however you want to apply that, and just be aware of those best practices to address these issues and have some backup. Like if our, you know, social media sites get taken down, what's our backup? And if cops are breaking down our doors, like what ways can we make sure that we have each other's backs? Because it's going to get worse. You know, a lot of folks feel like there was a pressure release with Trump, you know, at least on his way. He's still holding on by his claws, clutching to that office. But it's not going to change for us. You know, indigenous youth from south of the so-called U.S. border, U.S.-Mexico border, is still locked up in cages. You know, that isn't going to change under this new administration. We only potentially will see an escalation, especially with the way that this administration is coming at further pushing and not backing down from promoting its support for resource colonialism. And that means more indigenous bodies are going to have to be put in the way that we are going to put our bodies in the way of their machinery. But that means the potential for us being targeted, attacked systematically again and locked up is that much more real.
So there's been a lot of things that have fed into this case. And again, I encourage people to read the Perilous Chronicle article, but you know, we've talked a lot about them, the COVID-19 pandemic, just the foundational context of resource colonialism and extraction. There's another case that's brought up in the article, the case of Kyle Martinson. I'm just curious if you all want to talk more about just kind of the deeper context of how these things intersect with what's going on with Lauren's case.
Well, yeah, I'll briefly introduce the topic and I'll let Klee say more about Kyle. But when I first got in touch with Lauren, I was asking him, you know, I had looked at his Facebook and I was trying to understand who this kid was, what his life experience was that led him here. And I noticed on his Facebook, he had mentioned this person, Kyle Martinson. And I researched his case and Kyle was, a friend of Lauren's who was killed, by medical neglect in the Coconino County Jail in 2019. And, you know, I asked Lauren about the things that led him here, that led to him being political, wanting to organize the protest. And the two things he pointed out were, one, the death of his friend Kyle Martinson, and two, when he read, quote-unquote, the treaties. And so those are the two things that I think back to when I think about Lauren's case and then try to structure in my mind what's important to him and what led him to where he is, his position as a Dene person, and also the death of his friend. Klee, do you want to talk to us a little more about Kyle?
2019, so last year, Kyle Martinson, who's a quarter Dene, and Coconino County Jail, just to let y'all know, is just right here in Conflena, so-called Flagstaff. And so all that's been going on in the nexus here throughout this region. Kyle Martinson was arrested for some charges, and he's a young Dene person, 20 years old. He was being held at the Coconino County Jail, and like in a basic welfare check, he had asked for help. He had begged for help. He was suffering some health issues. And the cops callously said, drink some water, you'll be fine. And the next morning, he was found dead with about 1.5 gallons of fluid pushing pressure on his lungs. So he drowned to death basically from pneumonia. And the cops, like, refused to give him the medical support that he consistently had requested before he died. So, yeah, I mean, like the fact that Lauren, you know, was skateboarding pals with him and then this happened tragically and in the midst of the George Floyd uprisings, I can imagine that anybody would be pissed off and rage, you know, want to rage against these machines. But, yeah, this is, you know, something that has happened here in the family has called for justice. They filed a lawsuit against the Cocoa County Sheriff's over the treatment here at the jail, and that situation's ongoing.
Well, let's now turn and talk about how people are supporting Lauren. You mentioned there was an anti-repression group that's been formed. What have people been doing?
Yeah, the Tucson Anti-Repression Committee has been doing great work on social media, putting out information about Lauren and also collecting donations. It's hard to even express how expensive it is to be facing federal charges and also to be facing those while incarcerated. Just hugely expensive to be in prison. Everything costs tons of money. And so, yeah, the economic damage done to Lauren and his family, we're only going to be able to barely scratch the surface of that. But yeah, the Anti-Repression Committee here is doing great work, raising money for him and trying to call attention to his case. And so, yeah, donations help, spreading information about his case, all very helpful. And Klee and other people in Flagstaff have been collaborating with the Anti-Repression Committee here to do that work.
The Flagstaff Anti-Repression Committee, or FORCE, we're spurred into action after TARC contacted us, notified us that the detention hearing was going to be occurring here at the federal courthouse in so-called Flagstaff. And so we mobilized support and tried to raise awareness and bring more folks in. And that sort of spurred us to look at a range of cases that we've been addressing and a range of other folks that have been targeted as well here in occupied Kintlena to form this this crew. And so folks have been pretty active in working very closely with TARC to make sure that Lauren and other folks who have been caught up in attacks by the state have the support that they need and that they don't stand alone.
Yeah, so people can follow Tucson Anti-Repression on Instagram. It's at Tucson Anti-Repression, or on Twitter at Tucson ARC. And then also, if you go to Forgive Everyone and find the article, it'll be linked, I imagine, in the show notes. Forgive Everyone collaborated with Perilous to provide some funding for research to produce this original article. And they, at the bottom, did a really good job of putting all these links to ways that people can support Lauren. And most of those are, connecting to TARC's social media presence, but also his address is there. People can very carefully, especially reading the security concern statements on that page, just talking about how to carefully write to pretrial detainees, because they're, the things that are written to them can affect them, of course. But Lauren loves to get letters. He loves talking to people. He's like very friendly and very kind, loves the attention, like people writing to him. And he also needs books and money. You can send commissary money. You can either send that to Tucson Anti-Repression, they're supporting him and collecting the money, but also you can send directly commissary money directly to Lauren.
Yeah, I definitely encourage people to write letters and send books, and we will have all that linked in the show notes. You can see how to support. Well, anything else you all want to say? I mean, this is just, it's a really messed up case. And obviously, I think anybody listening to this can see how this could potentially impact them. Anything else you want to say on it, or any other closing thoughts?
Nothing in particular for me. I appreciate you making time to talk about the case and draw more attention to Lauren's situation.
Yeah, I just want to thank you all for highlighting this case and being open to address the range of these issues. I think it's really critical for folks to, if they're not already organizing anti-repression crews, look at a range of the other models that are out there, or reach out and support ones that and connect with ones on a regional basis, because this organizing, it's not that complicated. Anybody could do it, and everybody should be doing it, especially folks who are in some of these frontline communities where it's popping off. Like, we need to have that like line of support, and that is a lifeline of support. So highly recommend folks like just exploring different resources that are out there, checking out Sprout Distro and a range of other like anarchist Black Cross formations with a range of resources, how to do prisoner support, how to do jail support, and then like link up with like legal support on that level, because there are multiple spaces where we need to be fighting these charges. We need to be making sure that also proactively we have like good security culture practices, especially as the state escalates and uses new like new strategies, new tactics to go after folks to make sure that we keep our people safe. And I think that that's one of the most important things that all of us can be doing, is just like, because security culture doesn't work. It's not even a culture unless we're all practicing it. We're all participating. We're reinforcing that, and we normalize the behaviors and make sure that those insecure behaviors, those practices, like, and that even comes down to like perpetuating and supporting like oppressive behaviors and actions, making sure that we're checking that, because that is insecure culture. And so that's an important component to address, to be organized, be proactive on, and making sure that we're being smart about our actions so we have less folks that we need to support, but we are there and we're organized when folks do get caught up.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us, and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.